Given what I took to be the nature of this conference, I decided to address a big theme, which is the relation between language and communication, with a view to trying to reconcile two quite different views about the way in which language is typically construed, one that I associate more with philosophers and psychologists and the other with linguists who I'm familiar with, generative grammarians. And there's a slight evolutionary dimension to the picture that I'm going to draw, so it's a little bit speculative, but I hope it will be at least coherent and consistent. Okay, so Chris just touched on ostensive communication. I take this to be a human-specific capacity, perhaps one of the many that that Celia mentioned. Here's a particular example of ostensive communication. This is from Michael Tomasello, a very apt example. I'm at the front of the lecture hall getting ready to give a lecture. A friend in the lecture fiddles with her shirt button. Let's say she's in the front row here. She's frowning intently at me as she fiddles. And when I look down, I see that my button is unbuttoned. And as he says, comprehension of this little pantomime, this iconic gesture, depends fundamentally on an understanding of the intention to communicate behind the gesture. Without recognizing my friend's intention to communicate, I will see her button fiddling as some kind of idle behavior, or perhaps instrumental, she's doing up her own button, rather than as an action designed to inform me of something. And we use many different kinds of ostensive behaviors, pointing with a sort of directed eye gaze. Eye gaze is very important frequently in our use of ostensive stimuli. Gesturing of various sorts, pantomiming, as in this example, demonstrating, and of course, speaking and signing. And mostly these would be quite weird actions if they were not understood as intended communicatively. Compare these ostensive cases with something like the following. I leave a broken cup in a prominent place on the kitchen table, intending my partner to notice it and to realize that I'd like him to fix it. It's intentionally informative, but it's not ostensive, it's not overt, and crucially, it's deniable. So if he challenged me about this, I could find other plausible reasons, non-communicative reasons, for why that cup ended up being placed there by me. So my focus is ostensive communication, and I think, along with Sperber and Wilson, whose definition this is, it has this two-level intentional structure. The communicator produces a stimulus with the intention to make it mutually manifest to the audience and communicator that the communicator intends, by means of the stimulus, to make manifest to the audience a set of propositions or thoughts, or whatever you want to put in that slot. The key thing there is the notion of making mutually manifest to audience and communicator. That one has a particular informative intention. That's what's missing from the broken cup example, where there's an informative intention but not a communicative intention. Okay, so when we are presented with, as we are a huge number of times in any given day, with one of these ostensive acts of ostensive communication, we are called upon to carry out inferential comprehension. So, thinking about the first example, grasping the communicatively intended content of that iconic gesture, that fiddling gesture with the shirt button, which is a case of representation by resemblance, this requires inferring what the relevant components of that gesture are. That it is an action on a shirt button. The specific button is not actually relevant here. It's not as if she's inviting him to come down and over to her and to do up her button. No, that's not a relevant part of the stimulus, and we have to infer that. We have to be able to figure that out. And we also have to be able to infer, of course, what the intended information actually is, which is something like, one of your shirt buttons is undone, you should do it up. And I would say that comprehending a linguistic utterance is, in essentials, very similar. Of course, there's some coded information here, which greatly enhances our communicative capacities, the fine-grainedness of what we're able to get across. However, there's a huge amount of pragmatic, as we call it, inference required here to recover the intended content, the referent of the pronoun he, the time span of now, the intended meaning of finish. Finish in what sense? Finished some activity, finished a lecture, or he's finished, he's washed up, he's done for, and the various implications that might go with either one of those meanings. We can go home because he's finished his lecture, or, on the other hand, his career is over, he's done for. And on the relevance theoretic approach developed by Sperber and Wilson, Dan Sperber and Deirdre Wilson, which I've worked a lot within, the idea is that these acts of ostensive communication come with a particular presumption of relevance. We call it optimal relevance, and I'm not going to go into the technical details here, but the basic idea is that I'm imposing on you, I'm requesting your attention when I produce an act of ostensive communication. I'm calling upon you to exert some of your, use up some of your processing effort, and therefore you're entitled to expect a certain level of cognitive effect, cognitive benefit. And it's this sort of expectation, which needs to be developed in more detail than I can here, which constrains the pragmatic inferential process. And I've spent a lot of my, a ridiculous amount of my academic career trying to support the statement at the end here, which is that understanding human verbal communication, linguistic communication, is never a matter of mere decoding. It's never a matter of just decoding the linguistically given information. It always involves a degree of pragmatic inference, no matter how explicit and detailed the linguistic information. I'm not going to defend that here. Okay, so I want to just say that it seems to me that ostension comprehension, inferential comprehension, is a specialism of theory of mind, or mind reading, whatever term you prefer, where we take this to be the meta-representational ability to attribute contentful mental states to others, thoughts, beliefs, desires, intentions, and so forth. One component of mature human social cognition. And pragmatics, as we call it, which is the understanding of acts of ostensive communication, requires meta-representational abilities of several orders. It requires at least the ability to attribute a meaning to a speaker, that is, to represent an intention of the speaker towards a representation of one's own. So it's a very specific kind of second-order meta-representation. In fact, in most instances, I think higher orders of meta-representation are probably required. Sperber and Wilson developed the idea, defend the idea, that the inferential comprehension of ostensive stimuli may actually be a sub-module of the mind-reading module. So that would be a kind of automatic application of this specific, specialized, relevance-based procedure, which is triggered by ostensive stimuli, and in particular, linguistic utterances. You don't have to buy into that, I think, to nevertheless think it's reasonable to talk about this as a function of the theory of mind system. Okay, so on the basis of what I've said so far, language doesn't seem to be either necessary or sufficient for ostensive communication. Nevertheless, you could still maintain this common sense kind of assumption, which I think most people out there have, which is that language is for communication. And Dan Sperber puts this point of view from a sort of evolutionary perspective when he says, a meta-representational ability most likely developed for social reasons having to do with cooperation and competition. I think that's the standard story about theory of mind. That then, that meta-representational ability made a form of inferential communication possible, initially as a side effect. The beneficial character of this side effect turned it into a function of meta-representations, and then created a favorable environment for the evolution of a new adaptation, a linguistic ability. So the idea there is that the linguistic ability developed in the service of ostensive communication. Now, this is very much at odds with the view of that linguist you might have heard of, Noam Chomsky. who would claim, who has claimed many, many times, that language isn't first and foremost for communication. If it's for anything, and he doesn't like that way of talking, but if it is for anything, it's for thinking with, according to him. And in fact, he says it's quite poorly adapted for use in communication. And he gives lots of exemplification of this. I'm just going to give you an indication. So we form these WH questions in English. Is it just a little bit of linguistics? Who do you think John saw Bill with, where the who is associated with that gap after with there? That's a perfectly grammatical sentence. It's a pretty immediately interpretable. But consider the next two cases. Who did John see Mary and? Who does Sue believe the claim that hit John? These are not grammatical. The generative grammar that we native speakers of English have does not generate these sentences, and yet they seem to be perfectly interpretable, perfectly comprehensible. There's no great difficulty in seeing that the question is about who it is, in addition to Mary, that John saw in number two. So, why is that? More problematic, perhaps, is that these silent elements, these gaps, create ambiguities, unhelpful ambiguities. So consider the sentence, what did John say that Mary believed? Two meanings. The first being, what is it such that John said that thing and Mary believed that thing? The second one, what is it such that John said that Mary believes it or believed it? Yeah. So the question here would be, well, how useful is it to have this ambiguity? It's not communicatively efficient to have it in any way, and it would hardly be difficult to have some little pronounced element where I've got the X's and Y's and so forth, which indicated with perfect clarity what relation the what element is intended to have with the verbs in the sentence. So why not have a linguistic system of that sort if it's meant to serve communication? This is the sort of question that Chomsky asks. And then there are various problems caused by perfectly grammatical sentences, problems caused for our human parsing system. So famous one, the horse raced past the barn, fell. Hope you're having problems parsing that. You won't have if you've done Language 101, perhaps. Okay, so what does Chomsky think language is for? What's its first function? Well, his thinking is that language enabled humans to have a new kind of thought, to have thoughts with complex recursive structures. And as Smith and Allott, who have written this very good Making Chomsky Easy book, says it's not hard to see why such a change might persist once it has happened. So whatever causes recursion, recursive structures to come into being, once we've got them, they're extraordinarily adaptive, useful in thought. It would have adaptive value to be able to think things like, he knows that I want the flint, but he doesn't know that I know where it is. Even without being able to say such things, use them communicatively. So the idea then with Chomsky is that natural language is the language of thought, and that externalization, as he calls it, for use in communication is a later application. Okay, then in a sort of interesting paper in 2002, where he becomes a little bit more conciliatory, a little bit more open to ordinary folk views of language, Chomsky, together with Hauser and Fitch, says that in order to investigate this thing we call language in a useful, productive way, we actually have to fractionate it. We have to separate out its parts. It's not a monolith. So it's important to distinguish between questions concerning language as a communicative system and questions concerning the computations underlying the system, such as those underlying recursion. And so what they did was they made this distinction between the narrow I-language, internal language system, which is essentially just recursive syntax, and its mappings to various interfacing systems are the two crucial ones, or generalization of a number of others, are the conceptual intentional systems on the one hand, so pre-existing conceptual systems, and sensory motor systems, which would enable externalization and thus use in communication. So it's just mappings to those interfaces. To distinguish that narrow notion of language from a particular broader notion of language as something public, as something social, a vehicle for communication, which would include the narrow language faculty as a proper subpart, and a range of other parts, including a system of public meaning conventions. Do you want to say a little bit of a word about those now? So it's a widely held view, related to the languages for communication type view, that conventions play a central role in language. And I think this is largely, I would associate this with philosophers and perhaps some psychologists. So Lepore and Stone say language is a social competence, and any particular language consists of a set of conventions, including, for example, the senses of words, often multiple senses, as in the words newspaper or mouth. You stop to think about those, they're multiply polysemous. And various usage conventions, the ways in which we use language for certain social purposes. Tom Scott Phillips, in his recent book, says languages are cultural objects, which are sets of conventions created in order to enhance the expressive capacity of ostensive communication. Now, I'm not too worried about the right definition of conventions here. If you like David Lewis's definition or Ruth Millikan's definition, that's fine. I'm going to leave that intuitive for the time being. Now, this part of language, this aspect of language, the conventional aspect, is something which is evolving all the time. Innovative uses of words are becoming routine and ultimately becoming new conventions of the language. So consider the example I've got there, Sally Houdini'd her way out of the prison cell. I don't know whether this is fully conventionalized yet. I think perhaps it isn't quite. It still has a slight feeling of newness about it. It's obviously based on the proper name, Houdini, the man Houdini, and I guess it's fully comprehensible to everybody. This is what I would call the phenomenon, this kind of innovative use of language is what I would call the phenomenon of ad hoc meaning creation, which arises in the very process of ostensive linguistic communication. We're doing this all the time. When you start looking at it closely, you realize this is just going on all the time. Much of it's ephemeral, but in some cases, a meaning convention becomes established and the lexicon grows. So we now have totally integrated into English the words lynch, boycott, sandwich, all of which were originally derived from proper names. Thank you. And Houdini may be moving in that direction. Okay. So in these cases of innovative word uses, which lead to this sort of cultural evolution, if you like, of the language system, you've got a starting point. You've got the whatever the linguistic or social convention is for the name Houdini being attached to a particular man with particular properties. Something that's of considerable interest, to me at least, is how conventions begin. How the convention system that we have, the system of meaning conventions in English, actually arose without anything, as it were, to build on. And it's very difficult, of course, to think of ways in which we can investigate this kind of a question. Except that it turns out that there's a kind of natural experiment going on in the shape of what's called home sign. This is where a language is created or emerges essentially from nothing. The situation is that of deaf children, very young deaf children, who are not exposed to a conventional sign language. They're born into a family where they've got hearing parents, everyone around them is a hearing person using speech and so forth. So they're getting essentially no linguistic input. Nevertheless, they develop a large set of words or idioms consisting of discrete gestures paired with concepts or senses. Although they're linguistically isolated, at least in those early years of their lives, they are socially active and fully integrated into family life. And the signs that they develop are negotiated and calibrated and recalibrated in the process of ostensive communicative interactions. And some of them, many of them, go on to stabilize into lexical meaning conventions. They're not only iconic or deictic, they also show, so I read in the wonderful work of Susan Golden Meadow, they also show surprising degrees of arbitrariness, like any standard language. Moreover, and this is sort of crucial to the picture of language that I'm trying to put to you, the children combine these gestures into complex structures with many of the hallmarks of typical human syntax. They have consistent word order. In fact, they're ergative languages, for those who are interested. They're recursive and give rise to hierarchical phrase structure as a result. And in this respect, they're quite different from the ways in which co-speech or co-sign gestures, which we all use, co-speech gestures, manifest themselves. When those combine, and they don't, I think, very often, but when they do, they combine into a flat structure, not a hierarchical structure. So as Josh Armstrong, who looked at this in his PhD thesis, says, it looks as if home sign gives strong evidence for both a human language faculty of the sort that Chomsky describes and semantic conventions of the sort that Lewis describes. Both emerge, one could say, within ostensive communicative interactions of the deaf children with their caregivers, but the signs, the semantic conventions, are in fact actually created through communication, via coordination and communication, some of which become routine and eventually conventionalized. So, on the basis of this this kind of evidence, which is wonderful to have, my overall picture, I just want to end with this, of the sort of relative priorities in a story about the language communication relationship, priorities and dependencies between different aspects, is given here. I'll just read it. Language as narrowly construed, the Chomskyan construal, is just this internal recursive merging of discrete symbolic components. And if he's right about this, when this came into being, however it came into being, it enabled new complexity of thought, including meta-representation. Meta-representation is a key component of theory of mind, the ability to represent and attribute content for mental states to others. That in turn enables this ostensive inferential communicative capacity we have. I would call that an instinct, others might not agree. And that in itself provides a favourable, highly favourable environment for the use of language as broadly construed. I take it this is what Dan Sperber was talking about. This is the externalisation of those internal recursive linguistic structures and the establishing of a public lexicon of semantic conventions. So that's a kind of attempt without very much in the way of argument or evidence, a kind of attempt to give a big picture of the way in which language and communication can be seen in relation to each other. Thank you.